My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. In the beginning of civilization, the feminine divine was preeminent. Sacred images of the goddess have been found in archaeological digs around the world. Goddess images represented all aspects of life from birth to death. Dating back to at least 1200 BCE in pagan Ireland, the Morrigan was the goddess of war, witchcraft, death, protection, and retribution. She was also the patron of motherhood, healing, shape-shifting, and the land. What can women and men learn from this powerful feminine figure? In this time of the Me Too movement and a resurgence of women's empowerment, how can the story of this Celtic goddess of magic and might inspire and reawaken us? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, Courtney Weber, shares her exploration of the mythology and history of the Morrigan and what it offers to those who seek a renewed perspective on the power of the feminine divine. Courtney Weber is a Wiccan priestess, writer, tarot advisor, metaphysical teacher, and social activist. A practicing witch since her teens, her passion is bringing the wonders of magic, and that's magic with a K, to our modern world. She's the author of Brigid, History, Mystery, and Magic of the Celtic Goddess, and Tarot for One, The Art of Reading for Yourself. Her website is CourtneyAWeber.com, and she joins us this week to discuss her new book, The Morrigan, Celtic Goddess of Magic and Might. Please welcome to Destination Unlimited, Courtney Weber. Welcome, Courtney.
Hi, Victor. Thank you so much for having me. As I mentioned, it's really a pleasure to be back.
And it's wonderful to be talking to you again. I think the last time we spoke was about 4 or 5 years ago. So
yes.
We're going to bring everybody up to date and tell us a little bit about you. You were called to the world of magic, and that's magic with a K, as we say, at a very young age. Please share with us your early path and the origin of your calling.
You know, it was really a combination. It was one really... honestly, being in love with the with the religions of my childhood. I was raised technically Roman Catholic, but my mother's family is Southern Baptist, and both of those faiths have a lot of magic in them. I loved the rituals of the Catholic Church, and I loved its antiquity, but I always felt like there was something more that I wasn't quite getting from the masses. And my mom's family, or my mom's family's faith, is full of an acknowledgement of a spirit world, but there's also a lot of fear around that. And sometimes when you're in a Southern Baptist culture, there will be a touching on the idea of spirits and ghosts, but almost always the conversation shifts away from that right away. And I was always tantalized by those pieces within those two faiths, but I was never able to grasp hold of it. And as I got older, I had my own political and moral conflicts with both of those institutions, and so went on my own way. But I've always had a real, just a real hunger and curiosity for fairy tales, and a belief that magic was real, but you had to find it. And then as I got older, I realized it wasn't as hard to reach as I thought it was, that it was really all around, and it really was a lot about noticing that the magic you create, the intentions you put out there do manifest, but sometimes in very subtle ways or surprising ways. The kinds of magic we see in Hollywood, the flash, the bang, the immediate transformation of someone to a toad, those are all symbols of what magic actually does. A lot of times people talk about, if you're a witch, why can't you turn someone into a toad? And the answer is, well, I can. But actually change their physical structure to turn them into an amphibian is beyond any sort of possibility in the world of physics. So no, I can't do that. But when you think about what does it mean to be a toad, does it mean somebody who's covered with warts and is kind of slimy and repulsive? Well, you know, perhaps those that those identities exist in all of us. So casting a spell on someone to become a toad maybe brings those traits forward. Then people start to see them as many people start to think of toads. But unless you think of a toad as someone who can blend in, who is a very important part of the ecosystem, who in a way we study frogs' bodies to learn a lot about the world that we live in. So the toad itself is also a source of wisdom. And again, those traits also belong to all of us. So turning someone into a toad may mean that casting a spell that brings out their abilities to blend in, their abilities to adapt to any environment, but also their abilities to bestow a lot of wisdom onto people that are seeking it. So it's really a matter and some people talk about, like, you know, if you're, so those kinds of I don't even want to say stereotype so much, but I think a misunderstanding of the symbolism and what those things really mean versus what magic and witchcraft can actually do.
So your philosophy of magic really is intention and the various aspects that intention can manifest in.
It is, and it's also noticing and making sure that you recognize that what you've created is actually what has come to you. I know that. And also it is about living an intentional life as well. I once made a very, very good love potion that was doing a lot of good for people. But a friend of mine took it and she used it on herself. And then she complained to me that it hadn't worked. And I asked her right off. I said, "Did you put that love potion on you, like perfume, and then sit on your couch and turn on the television?" And she admitted that, yeah, that's what she had done for the past month. When she'd come home from work, she put on the love potion and she'd just gone and watched TV. I said, "Well, did you really think the men were just going to come out of the television and manifest in your living room? No, you need to be out and meeting people," which is, you know, also being complicit with your intention to bring someone into your life. You've got to create the space for them to come in, which for some people may mean getting out and going to a club or joining a hiking club or just even starting an online profile. And bringing the right people to you.
It's like the story of the man who is very pious in his particular religion and goes to his gathering place every Sunday and says that his wife needs an operation and asks that the divine allow him to win the lottery. And the week goes by and nothing happens, and he keeps doing this week after week, and finally he cries and he rents his clothing and says, "What would you have me do?" And the voice comes down and says, "Buy the ticket." So the magical work, but we have to invest in it ourselves.
Exactly.
Now, were there other members of your family who were interested in this when you were a child, or was this something unique to you?
This was something very unique to me, and not to say that I haven't had family members come to me for tarot readings or assistance quietly since then, which has happened. I have a very large extended family, and then many of them have come with confessions that they're of experiences that they've had and beliefs that they've had, and also asking for assistance. So although I'm the only one that has really embraced it, I'm certainly not the only one that uses it.
Tell us about your training and initiation as a priestess.
So that was very, very strange. I live in Oregon now, but I didn't for quite a while. And I went to college here. And just before I moved to the East Coast, and I was going to move to New York and pursue a career in theater. And I had been hanging out with a coven in a grove out here in Oregon. And they talked about starting a priestess initiation training program. But I didn't think much of it since I was leaving. And when I was in, and I don't think that the high priestess there really expected that I would join for that very reason. But just before I moved, I had a very powerful vision when I was at a festival out here in Oregon. And in talking with my priestess about it, she said, "I think this is a sign that this might be a path for you." And at first I resisted it, which is a telltale sign of somebody being called to mysticism is first you say, no, that's not for me. And, I said, "It can't possibly work. I'm moving to New York City and there's no witchcraft out there," which is pretty hilarious, especially, but I had no idea. And she said, "Well, you can train remotely. We have this wonderful internet." And I said, "All right." So I started studying and turning in assignments remotely. And I did my work, and it was funny. 13 of us started and 2 of us finished. And when we finished and I received the initiation, I thought, okay, well, I did my job. That's done. And as anyone who's had an initiation knows, it's really the beginning, because as soon as I was out in the world as a priestess, without even saying it, people started to come to me and ask me to teach them, help them, guide them, that sort of thing. And before I knew it, I was running a coven, which grew into one of the largest magical communities on the East Coast. And I had to race to catch up in many ways and try to stay one step ahead of the people who I was supposed to lead. So I tell people I really had a crash course in priestessing. There are a lot of traditions out there that make you take a lot longer. And I see value in that. Of course, there's also value in the way that I did it as well. But I don't know that I would necessarily recommend it that way. And so when I train people now, I make sure they have quite a bit of time to prepare and be solid in what they do before racing out there to lead the masses, if you, as it were.
Your way. Tell us about your way and what are the responsibilities in your practice as a priestess?
We are a progressive witchcraft tradition in that our magic needs to be directly benefiting the world by first benefiting the local community. It doesn't make sense to cloister ourselves and just study very esoteric things without actually doing it. The people who come through me are really focused on social justice work and improving their communities. One of my priestesses is a prison chaplain. Another one has worked with children, helping them with literacy. Another woman is a very much dedicated to animal rights in her area and taking in supporting the local animal shelters. So there are very specific, the work needs to be focused on the people around you, whether or not they themselves believe in magic or whether they themselves would identify as witches or pagans.
Wonderful. Social activity combining the beauty of magic. My guest is Courtney Weber. She's the author of The Morrigan, Celtic Goddess of Magic and Might. And we'll be back with Courtney after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Tune in to The Practical Intuitive, Mind, Body, Spirit for the Real World, with me, host Robin Fritz, Mondays at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 Eastern. I'll cover personal and business intuition, animal communication, mediumship, space clearing, past life regression, shamanic insights, energy healing, soul choice, and more, all to help you tap your own intuitive and healing skills. No ifs, ands, or buts.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
A ranger station.
I'd like to report a bear hug.
Okay.
I put out my campfire and Smokey Bear hugged me.
So you drowned the fire, you stirred it, drowned it again, and felt that it was cold?
Uh-huh.
Yep, he's just letting you know you did good.
Bear hug from Smokey Bear. Status update.
I'm gonna let you go now.
There are many ways to start a fire, but one sure way to put it out. Learn how you can do your part at SmokeyBear.com.
Sponsored by the U.S. Forest Service Ad Council and your state forester.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Courtney Weber. We're going to be talking about her brand new book, The Morrigan, Celtic Goddess of Magic and Might. Before we talk about that, let's talk about your tarot practice and your tarot deck. While living in New York, you created your own tarot deck, the Tarot of the Burrows. What was your inspiration for this, and how do your cards differ from other decks?
Well, I was doing a lot of readings at very large parties for very drunk people. And I also was reading in the burlesque clubs and stuff like that in downtown. And I was just it was really, really fun. It was one of my favorite periods of my life. But I'm literally shouting interpretations at people that are looking for a very quick answer. It's a very noisy space, a lot of distractions. And so my messages have to be really clear. I don't have the ability to wand philosophically. It had to be like, this card here represents your boss, okay? And this card over here represents the terrible things he's doing to you. Just really direct stuff. And the more I did that, the more I started to see the images of the tarot characters as I was walking through the city. So the King of Pentacles might be somebody who's in a suit and is racing to Wall Street. Is somebody who's really absorbed with making money and that sort of thing. Or if I remember if the Strength card, there was a young woman I was working with who's a queer immigrant activist and she was very small in stature, but very powerful in spirit. And to me, I was like, I think this is the Strength card. She's just walking right in. So I have a picture. Her picture is holding open the subway doors. So that was my journey. There were a lot of questions and challenges that I had along the way. Sometimes it was difficult to find specifically the right image and how I wanted to portray that, particularly with something like the devil, because the devil we often have is this connotation of pure evil. But to me, I thought of the devil as more temptation, and I didn't want to place one kind of person or archetype with the devil card. I had some people who said the devil should be a cop, or the devil should be a judge, or the devil should be drugs. And I said, well, I can agree to a point with any of those images, but I'm also not here to tell people what I think. I'm here to try to help them figure out what they think. And so I ended up with the devil card with this very beautiful woman not a over-sexualized outfit, but she was wearing leather pants and a leather jacket. So you had a sense that she could take you on an adventure. And we overexposed the image so you couldn't quite see her. So you had the sense that perhaps the person who's looking at her has been partying a little too much and is not quite seeing clearly. And you don't really know what she's there or what she's wanting from you. And so it could be great. She could take you to a place unknown, take you to some place that's really scary, or she could steal your wallet. And so we wanted that, and that's one of the great mysteries of the devil and the tarot cards, is that very often when the devil shows up, it's probably something you want to avoid, unless this is part of yourself that you need to uncover or you need to face. Is it a fear that you need to overcome? In that case, it's time to embrace the devil and let him or her take you on that journey. So how mine differs is the fact that it was, at the time, it's about 10 years old now, so it's already a little bit, I don't want to say dated, I'm going to say vintage. I know it's not quite vintage yet, but it really encapsulated for the time who those specific characters and people were in an urban environment. New York City is quite an iconic city, and so even if you don't live in New York City, you probably have recognized those characters in your own, even if you live in a small town, right? I live in a very small town now, but you can tell who the wealthy people are when you're walking down the street, and you can tell, you know, who's had a tougher time of late. So it was a really powerful project, and I'm happy and sad to say we've officially sold out our run. So I don't have any that I have for sale at the moment. However, I do think there are a couple available on eBay and Amazon. So if someone is interested in a photographic modern tarot deck, then you are able to find them in those places.
Is there a new deck in your future?
You know, not at the moment. Every once in a while, I flirt with an idea of one. My own tarot practice and the decks that I've been attracted to have become, I've gone way back in time, and I'm now working really just with the classical decks. And I think it's that, all right, I reached the edge of the modern tarot world, and now it's time to go back to the classic. And so I haven't had a calling to do another one. I'm not against it, but I just, that inspiration hasn't struck. Doing that first deck really took a lot out of me, personally, spiritually, and financially. And I honestly, looking back, I've written three books since then, and I'm working on a fourth, and the tarot deck was the hardest creative project I've ever done.
Mm.
Even harder than working on this Morrigan book, which meant sitting with a very, very challenging goddess for a year and a half and doing some really intense, sometimes confusing and challenging research. But the deck was really hard.
But you have a unique approach to your tarot readings, don't you?
Well, I would say so. Some people call me an anarchistic tarot reader. I don't follow a lot of spreads. My book, Tarot for One, has some great spreads in it because I can create a really good spread, but I never use them. So I read for a lot of different types of people in different situations. Up until recently, I was also working for a psychic hotline. And that was work that really tested me as a reader because some of the questions that brought forward were very, very difficult. And the needs and of people were sometimes things that I wished I had a little more training in psychology or therapy, so I could be a little more of assistance to some folks who may not have resources to therapy, but they can call a phone psychic just to talk to someone. My work is really a combination of prophecy, but also practical tools. I do believe there are some things in our life that are predestined, but I think a lot of our destiny we do have control over. A lot of times people call me and they want to know when they're going to meet their soulmate and when they're going to meet their one person, or is this person they're meeting the one? And the tarot will give them kind of a nebulous answer because they say things like, yeah, this relationship could work out, but you need to change a couple of things. Or they can say things like, yeah, you're going to probably meet a couple of people over the next year. And any one of them, depending on what's going on with both of you at the time, could really be a good relationship. But then there are some times where it's like this specific thing that you're working on is doomed to fail. And there's nothing you can do to change that. And part of that's because there are certain things I think we are supposed to do in our lives. And what those are is not always obvious to us. Sometimes we think we're doing one thing and it's actually about helping someone else, or it's about fixing something. It may be predestined that you work in a specific field or have a specific position. But the destiny is not itself about being the administrative assistant at the front desk. It's about the kind of support that you end up giving someone who interns for you. With not just their work, but also with their life and helping them navigate a difficult situation.
Yeah.
So that could be part of your soul work. And it's not just about what am I supposed to be doing for a living? It's more about what are you supposed to be doing in this lifetime?
We could probably do an entire show on that topic, and perhaps we will.
I would love it.
Because I've had those experiences myself where I've looked at life with certain intentions only to find out that the intentions that led me to point A actually took me to point B without me being aware of it. So, yeah, we'll do a show on that sometime in the future. So what drew you to start researching the Celtic deities?
So Brigid was the first goddess that I was exposed to in my witchcraft journey. And she and I just connected right away. And for me, it's like, hey, if this is working, let's just stick with it. So I didn't do a whole lot of exploration for many different deities when I found her. And I've always been very, very much drawn to the Celtic world and Ireland in particular. And I've made a number of trips to Ireland. And the more... when you research one Celtic or in this case, an Irish deity, you start finding myths of others who are in that specific realm and pantheon. And the mythology is just so fascinating. It's really tough. It oftentimes doesn't really make any sense at all when you first look at it. But my favorite part about mythology is looking at what the myths might have meant to the people that first wrote or first told those myths. So for example, in the Morrigan, there's a lot of myths in which the Morrigan sisters delivers a warning and the people don't listen. Everybody dies. And you start to think this is a very morbid canon of mythology, but a friend of mine who's an Irish priestess said that she believes that the myths all represent things you shouldn't do. They're warnings against hosting strangers for too long, or breaking your taboos or your promises to the local land deities and the kinds of problems that can result if you do that. So the more I researched not just the myths, but also the lives of the Celts, the more enthralled I was and the more I wanted to learn.
In the pantheon of the Celtic goddesses, including Bridget and Maeve and Danu, where does the Morrigan fit in?
So it's really interesting. So this, unlike the, right now for my next book, I'm doing, I'm working on Hecate. And so she has Hecate herself and many from the ancient Greek and Roman world have a, although complicated and sometimes contradictory family lineage, you can see exactly where they fit in. And this really isn't the case with the Morrigan, like with the exception of one myth that many think was coined in the Victorian era and really isn't part of the original Irish and Celtic pantheon. The Morrigan and Bridget don't really have a lot to do with one another. So it's hard to see exactly how they fit in unless you look at their origin stories and that they both came from the Tuatha De Danann, who were the first people who came to Ireland, according to the myths. And some say they were ascended ancestors. Some say they were demigods that came. And the Morrigan is a goddess of things that really frighten. And she's the goddess of strategy and helping when the times get really, really tough. So the men are out there fighting, the gods are out there fighting, and they start to get exhausted. But it's the Morrigan who's able to come in and say, look, you're not done yet. You need to get up and you need to finish what you started.
Mm. We're going to be talking more about the Morrigan after our break. My guest is Courtney Weber. Her new book is called The Morrigan, Celtic Goddess of Magic and Might. Courtney, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you and your work.
Well, I always encourage people to go to their local metaphysical bookstore first and ask for it. Let's support our small businesses. Most metaphysical bookstores are likely to carry it. If they're not, they can probably order it for you. And if you can't get it there, you don't have a bookstore near you, you can order it from Amazon. Whether or not you order from Amazon, please leave a review. Those really, really help. Within a couple of weeks, I will have books for sale on my website. And my website is CourtneyAWeber.com. That's with one B, not two.
And we'll be back with more of Courtney and the Morrigan after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
You're listening to OTR-FM, part of the iOM Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Grab a cup of tea or a glass of wine and tune in for inspired conversations with publisher Linda Joy on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Linda creates sacred space for leading female luminaries, empowering authors, heart-centered female entrepreneurs, coaches, and healers. A soulful venue where guests openly share the fears and obstacles they've overcome, wisdom and lessons learned, and the personal journey that led them to the transformational work they do in the world. Inspired conversations to empower you on your path to authentic, soulful living.
Teens in foster care will love you, even if you don't know the lingo.
Dad bod, noun. The result of the occasional donut always washed down with confidence.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council. Visit AdoptUSKids.org.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Courtney Weber. She's the author of The Morrigan, Celtic Goddess of Magic and Might. So tell us about your visit to the Cave of Cats in Ireland and its significance to the Morrigan story and your personal fascination with her.
So the Cave of the Cats is also is known as Awutnagat, and it was called in the medieval era the Cave to Hell, as it was believed that demons in the form of black cats would emerge from the cave on Samhain or Halloween night on October 31st. And it's also believed that this is where the Morrigan would come in and out of the fairy world. It's also thought that this might have been where the legendary Queen Maeve was born. It's a fascinating place. It's about, the cave itself is about 6 feet under. It's not all that big. And to get into the cave, you have to go in a hole in the ground that's about the size of an average adult's head and shoulder width. Mm. And you have to crawl on your kind of, I tend to crab walk. Some people crawl on their hands and knees through this passageway before the cave opens up into what is a very round, it really looks like a womb in there. And so the place is full of mud, and it's believed that that is one of the Morrigan's sacred places in Roscommon in Ireland. And the first time I went in there, I don't know exactly what I was looking for, only that it was part of the tour that I was on, and something very powerful happened. And on the way out, you have to, again, crawl back on your hands and knees and, you know, push yourself out through this hole in the ground, and you're covered in goo. So it's, the whole thing is a literal rebirth. But the fact that it's just about 6 feet underground has a sense that there's kind of a death and rebirth element to it as well. And so I've been in there 4 times now, I think, coupled with tours. And the last time I went there, I felt like it was my turn to go in by myself. And so my sweet husband waited on the outside of the cave, and I crawled in with nothing but a flashlight. And it was, I'm normally very excited to go in the cave, but this time going in by myself, I was nervous. And so I sat in there, turned my flashlight off, and I was in this very, very dark, dark place. And I'd been in a dark place emotionally as well, and feeling being in that space and being in that place of darkness, no longer feeling like places that are dark are scary as much as they are comforting. And just being allowed to be held up by the earth was something that was very, very powerful. And thinking about how the earth has held so much for so long, it can hold one person's sorrows as well. And so it seemed to be a place where I felt like the goddess was saying, you can leave these here. It didn't feel like the goddess was trying to solve anything for me or make all the problems go away, but more like you can sit beside me and you can leave this here. You don't have to leave with it on, with it still on your heart. And I felt like I was in there for quite a while, and she gave me a song to sing, which sometimes if it's in the right place, I'll sing it for people. And as I left, came back out, I felt like I'd been there for hours. My husband said I was only in there for about 15, 20 minutes. And it just was completely, there was a real shift that had happened in there.
How did your personal journey with the Morrigan change your life?
You know, it's, she's made me much more comfortable with grief, and comfortable with the paradoxes that come with that. As I was going through, as the journey itself made me, anytime I work with one of these goddesses, they come in and make me look at a lot of different things. One woman once said to me that she wished I could write a book for every deity. And I said, no, it's been hard enough as it is. They really do shake up your life when you bring them in, especially writing about them. Toward the end of our last journey in Ireland, my husband and I were in the Dulo Valley, which is this place of absolutely extraordinary beauty. And we stopped the car just so we could look around and, you know, not just through the window. And I just said, you know what? I'm okay. If there's lightning strikes me down, I'm just going to end it here and I'm going to be happy. This is the most beautiful place in the world. I love this place. This is perfect. And then I noticed there was a stone cross, and every time I see some kind of historical marker, I go over and read it. And it was a famine. It was a famine monument. And I read the story of what had happened in the Dulo Valley and how during the height of the famine, it was, I think it was a couple hundred people were looking for their local lord to see if he could either provide them with food or jobs or anything, as a lot of people need to understand about the famine. There was food in Ireland. It was just too expensive, and a lot of it was being exported to England. And the colonizing forces had no interest in addressing the starvation that was going on. And it was a literal genocide of the Irish indigenous people. And these specific individuals who were starving crossed through this valley in March, in the middle of the night, where it was very cold and snowy. And finally, actually in the morning, they crossed over. And by the time they got to the other side to find their lord, they were told he couldn't be disturbed because he and the other lords were at lunch. And so they would not stop their meal to address the needs of starving people. And so these people then had to cross back through the valley to go home. And by that point, it was nighttime, and many of them died in the night from exposure and also just from being weak with hunger. And it's said that a number of them died with green mouths because they were eating grass. And reading that story and knowing that that's exactly where I stood was where those things had happened, I suddenly absolutely hated that place. And I thought we should just burn this whole valley to the ground and just it shouldn't exist anymore, because that was just a horrible thing. And of course, it's very extreme thinking, but it really struck me. And it wasn't that paradox of one moment being enthralled with the place and another moment being completely abhorred by it, but realizing that the valley had nothing to do with what had happened within it. And that experience taught me more about the Morrigan than any book or myth, and that the Morrigan holds all of that paradox of that great beauty and that great wonder, but also that great horror. And it's not because she caused any of it, but she's there with it. She exists in parallel to the really great, powerful things in life, but also that which is really, truly terrible. And I'm so thankful I had that experience, because after we came back from Ireland, we had two great losses. One was a very old friend of mine passed away. And just after he and I had reunited as friends, we'd had a pretty bad falling out when we were younger. And just before he passed away, we'd managed to mend that fence and were excited to be in each other's lives again. We're looking forward to introducing our spouses to one another and, you know, actually having this, you know, family friends. And then he died very suddenly at a very young age. And I was, you know, absolutely in fury about that. And then my husband and I had been undergoing fertility treatments for about 4 years. And we achieved a pregnancy and we lost it very shortly after that. And those two things happened within about a month of each other. So that was an awful lot of grief and anger. But also at the same time, a really weird kind of joy, a joy at having known the person, a joy of having, you know, had a child even briefly, even if we never got to meet this child. And so there's not a lot of places you can take that kind of paradox. In our culture, there's a lot about trying to heal from grief right away and trying to let go of anger, but it never talks about that sometimes grief brings joy with it. And I was just really thankful that I'd been able to heal with my friend. And I was very thankful that I even met him in the first place. So where could I go with all of these paradoxical feelings? Well, the Morrigans, I just went to my Morrigan altar, lit my candles. And in that space, it was just like being in the cave again, where I just felt held, or being in the valley where I could see you can have a beautiful experience and that experience can also be terrible and they can exist simultaneously. You don't have to embrace one and reject the other. It's okay to be in both spaces. And I don't feel like our culture gives us a lot of permission to have multiple feelings that are really extreme at the same time. So I am very thankful that I could have that with the Morrigan. It's made a lot of challenges a lot easier since then.
Thank you for sharing that with us, because I'm sure that many of our listeners right now can identify with the experiences that you've gone through and the wonderful appreciation of the balance, because ultimately there is a balance, and I think that's what the lesson is here. As you had mentioned earlier, the Morrigan story was part of fairy lore. What was the connection between the fairy world and that of the goddess?
You know, it's so funny. I heard about the fairies is that the fairies are something except when they're not, and they're not something except when they are. And that comes from Morgan Daimler. So I want to give credit where it's due. And the Morrigan is a fairy except when she's not, and the fairies are not connected with the Morrigan except when they are. So it's another one of those delicious paradoxes that you just find yourself laughing about. So the fairies of course, most of your listeners may be aware of this, but in case they're not, Disney has not done much of a service to the legacy of fairies. In Ireland, sometimes the fairies are called the good neighbors or the good people or the other crowd. And there's a lot of respect there. And there's a great deal of acknowledgement. But as one of very famous fairy saying goes from Ireland is, I don't believe in fairies, but I wouldn't want to cross one. So there, people in Ireland typically don't go out seeking help from the fairies. Of course, there are exceptions, but in general, it's that we leave them alone, they leave us alone. Fairies were often blamed for misfortune that would fall upon the Irish in the pre-industrial Irish world. So things like illness, sick cattle, if the milk wouldn't turn and we couldn't get butter, then that would often be was believed that the fairies were the result of that that situation. And so the Morrigan was a goddess that could enter and exit the fairy mounds. So when the great Battle of Mortura, the second great Battle of Mortura was won, she was the one who could proclaim that victory to the people of the other crowd, as well as to the people of Earth. So she had some kind of connection in both worlds. And there are times when she acts like a fairy and that she steals cattle, which is something the fairies were blamed for. And there were times when she was very, you know, very gracious, and she might randomly bless a person just because she felt like she was in a good mood, because it was also believed that fairies could bless as well as curse. And, you know, she was often associated with the she mounds where the fairies were believed to live. So it's a bit of a nebulous connection. But it's certainly a real one. I think that may be the reason why a number of people struggle to connect with the Morrigan, because just like the fairies, they're not always interested in what's going on in what's happening with humans unless it benefits them. And sometimes it seems that the Morrigan is not particularly interested in humans for their own sake, but she may have purpose for what's going on with us that might serve some other work she's trying to do.
Fascinating. And so, fascinating. Yeah. My guest is Courtney Weber. She's the author of The Morrigan, Celtic Goddess of Magic and Might. And we'll be back with more of Courtney after these words on the Olden Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose: to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Change and growth are part of natural life, and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the Om Times Experts program. With Om Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
Looking for inspiration?
Want to be inspired?
Not sure where to go?
Find Mark and Kim every Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern on Inspired Living.
Topics will elevate consciousness and range from metaphysics to the human and social experience and all things spiritual.
Welcome to an inspired community that offers support, encouragement, and new ways of thinking. You are the inspired and the inspiration.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Courtney Weber. She's the author of The Morrigan, Celtic Goddess of Magic and Might. Courtney, why does the Morrigan have such a fearsome reputation?
Well, I think it's because of the myths that were eventually chosen by the monks to record. Most of the lore about the Irish gods in general were recorded by Christian or Catholic monks a couple centuries after Ireland had really become a Christian country. And so these stories were starting to become a thing of antiquity instead of something at present. And the Celts, because the Celts did not write any of their stories down, they didn't keep written records. I mean, they had some script that they would use to engrave in certain things, but they did not keep a written text in the way that the Greeks or Romans did, for an example. And that was by design. It was believed that it was better for the mind to memorize and recite things than it was to write things down, which must be true because I can't remember anything and I write everything down. There's a lot of stories of these old gods that are lost. It simply never gotten recorded. And I have a couple of theories. I think that the myths that in which the Morrigan is particularly gruesome, in which she shows up, or one of her sisters shows up with bloody entrails around her neck or blood coming out of her mouth and, really frightening people, is a lot more sensational than the goddess was along doing her work and she looked up at the sun and smiled. Right. So mythologies that tend to have a wider breadth of preservation, you'll find that gods and goddesses can be very boring sometimes, and or sometimes they can be very foolish. I mean, how many stories of indigenous deities they get into some folly because they drank too much and and had to either be rescued by other gods or had to get themselves out of a trap, and that sometimes they could be very frightening or they could be very kind. And so it's possible that just the scariest stories are the ones that we best remembered, because those are the stories that we generally best remember are the really frightening ones. We don't sit around the campfire and tell love stories. We sit around the campfire and tell ghost stories and scary stories. We always have as human beings. So, but I also wonder if, writing these myths down was a very expensive and laborious process for these Catholic monks. And so it stands to wonder why the church would allow the expense and the time of their monks to devote to this kind of preservation. And it may have been because the preservation of these very scary myths might have kept the local people from being tempted to return to the old faiths and might have kept them focused on being better Catholics or Christians. It may be because it might have been considered sinful to write about other gods and goddesses in a flattering way. And so, you know, according to the rules of the religion at the time, if you're going to write about another god or goddess, you need to make them look bad or scary. You know, we really don't know, but I think it's because of the stories that were preserved that give the Morrigan such a fearsome reputation. And, you know, her stories are scary. Right. She strategizes with her lover and then she runs to the ford to meet her lover's enemies. And they say she met him with two handfuls of blood. We don't really know what she did to him. I think she probably ripped his testicles out, because she also said she was going to take the kidneys of his valor, which to me sound like she was going after his nuts. Right. So and she also, part of her method of fighting is to bring fire from the sky and to screech and to terrify the enemy soldiers. And you also weren't quite sure which side she was on. In the great epic of the Tanbol Cuna, she sometimes seemed like she was really an enemy of the hero, and sometimes it seemed like she was on his side. And so sometimes it's not knowing if she's coming or going, or if she's going to help or if she's going to harm, may have been part of her legacy. And also probably her relationship with the fairies is something else that kept her very scary, because the fairies themselves were fearsome, terrifying creatures.
How did she inspire the Iron Age women of Ireland?
Gosh, you know, that's really hard to say. From what we know of the Celtic world, and we know more about the Celtic world because of some very early Irish tract laws, which may have been inherited from the pre-Christian Celtic world. And we know other things based on what the Romans wrote about the Celts, but the Romans, most of their writings about the Celts were European or British. They did not colonize Ireland. It's not to say they never made it there, but most of their experiences were further east. So we don't really know what roles for women were like. From what we can guess is that although Irish Celtic women certainly did not have equality, they had things a little better than continental European women. They could get divorces if they wanted to. but they couldn't own land unless very special circumstances dictated that they could become owners. But then they could not bequeath it to anyone. It would become, when they died, it would become common property or given to another man. And there are some cases in which Irish women became queens, but that was a lot less common than men becoming kings. So it's possible that the Morrigan stories were developed by women to help encourage one another, or perhaps point out the folly of the ruling patriarchy, which tends to be the stories of a lot of the Morrigan, is that she calls out men for making really foolish mistakes. And so to me, it may have, I can imagine mothers telling these stories to their daughters, saying, yeah, they're in charge, but look at what they're doing. Right. Or if we really want to fix the situation our tribe is in, we've got to get the men to do what we want them to do in order to preserve the life that we're leading.
Why is she often pictured with a raven?
So it's in many of her telltale sign was a black bird, essentially. And so that's often been translated into within more modern interpretations as being a raven, but in some of the older myths, they would say she was a black bird. So black birds, Royston crows, or buzzards in continental Europe or in England, it would have been the vulture. They don't have vultures in Ireland, but they certainly do have ravens and crows. Those are the birds that would follow the battlefield and would often pick the corpses clean. They were also believed to be messenger birds, that they could communicate with the gods. It's thought that at a time, the Celts actually kept ravens as trained pets. And so the ravens could either transmit messages or could give some kind of assistance to the people who trained them. So it was a pretty, it makes sense that she might be associated with that, because she did go to the battlefield. A lot of times the Celtic women would go to war with the men. They didn't always fight, but they did use psychological warfare, and that they would screech and contort their faces and make sounds that would emulate the warbirds and perhaps either scare away the enemy or bring about the spirit of death and destruction upon the enemy, as it was believed that was carried by those specific birds.
What may we learn from the Morrigan's shape-shifting, and how would this apply to us today?
It's such a good question. I think, and that was one of the tougher aspects of the Morrigan that I struggled with, but as I asked her, she could help me figure out how we could use that, because in her myth, she turns into an eel, she trips up one guy, then she turns into a heifer and she gets all the cows to run that guy down. She turns into a wolf that, scares the cows to run away and that kind of thing. So, so what is that about? And to me, it taught us how that we can change our situation and not accept things just based on what they look like. So I did when I was in the middle of this process with the Morrigan, there was, at my job, there was a list that was posted of people who had made a very specific contribution to our field and our company. And my name wasn't listed on it. And I was really upset. And first I was sitting here thinking, what could I have done differently? Where am I falling short? But then something told me to shift the perspective on the situation. So instead of just being upset and feeling so hurt, I took a really good look at the people on the list and realized I was every bit as good as some of those individuals. Some certainly I could learn to rise and meet their achievements, but others, objectively had not done as much. And so I reached out to the person in my company that had published that list and said, I think we should set up a meeting. And I sat down with him and I said, you missed me. I deserve to be on that list for these reasons. And, this person was listened, and they said, well, maybe you should just do more that I can see. And instead of me saying, okay, I'll work on that, I said, well, maybe you should just pay attention. And starting to take ownership of, instead of being like, oh no, what can I do to make this person like my work more? I was like, no, I don't have to do that. My work is good enough as it is. But what I can do is tell this person they ought to take a better look. And so it shifted a place of power. It didn't, you know, change anything for me professionally at that moment, but it did help me not take that so hard, right? I saw this cartoon this morning that I just loved. And at the top of a hill, there's a small rock that says goal. At the bottom of the hill, there's a person carrying a very, very large boulder that says self-doubt. And there's a little voice that's coming from above saying, maybe if you set down that boulder, it'll be easier to get to the goal. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh man, that's the kind of thing I always need to hear. So seeing that reminded me of that conversation of, embrace that. I know I'm good. I know what I'm good at doing. And it's not my fault that somebody else isn't paying enough attention.
Absolutely. What would you like readers to take away from The Morrigan?
Oh, gosh, that's such a good question. That's hard to say. I think that it's important to be okay. One thing, all right, here, the biggest thing I can say about The Morrigan is that she teaches us to proceed with fear, even when we are fearful, to acknowledge that we're scared of doing something or we're scared of something within us and proceed anyway. You know, she's not necessarily about getting over your fears. I think fear has a very important place, but fear should not be in the driver's seat. So if you're scared of something, talk to The Morrigan and say, you know what, I'm proceeding anyway. I'm going to use you as my inspiration and guide and move forward in a direction that will be productive for me ultimately.
My guest, Courtney Weber, her new book, The Morrigan, Celtic Goddess of Magic and Might. Courtney, one more time, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you and your work.
My website is CourtneyAWeber.com. I'm also on Twitter, at The Cocoa Witch is my Twitter handle. And you can also find me on Facebook. My author page is the best way to reach me there. But definitely check out my website. I have a lot of events coming up. I'm going to be in Phoenix and Utah early November. I'll be back in New York middle of November. And then I'm doing some book launches here in Portland, Oregon, toward the end of November. And I'll be in Walnut Creek, California in December. And I'll be signing books. And we'll be talking all about this incredible goddess and would love for people to come out.
Courtney, as always, wonderful to connect with you and share your wisdom. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Victor.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor, the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.